I've been told to keep my intro short. I will warn you, I'm keeping it as short as it was written by our guest. Thank you for joining us here at the Heritage Foundation in our Lewis Lehrman Auditorium. We, of course, welcome those who are joining us on our heritage.org website at this occasion. Those who are in the room, we'd please ask if you make that last courtesy check that your cell phones have been turned off to avoid interruptions, as well as for the recording of the event. Our internet viewers are always welcome to send questions or comments to us via email, simply addressing them to speaker@heritage.org. And we will post the program later today, hopefully, on the website for your future reference as well. Today's speaker first appeared on this platform 6 years ago as the inaugural presenter in our desire to feature programming to address the challenges we face in our culture. His unified theory of liberalism, under the featured title at that time of Regurgitating the Apple, is the most viewed video in Heritage's history.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Regurgitating the Apple.
Is what?
You'll get to this. And the late, great Andrew Breitbart called the talk, for those who want to go online and view it and test it out, one of the 5 most important conservative speeches ever given. We'll see about that one. In the interim, we have featured the talents of students from D.C. area schools in a one-woman show. Heritage has also hosted more than 36 authors whose works have reflected on our cultural strengths and social fabric. We have heard commentaries from other writers and thinkers on cultural affairs and research. We have screened some 40-plus documentaries or movies, and Heritage has even introduced its own video programming. All of this is familiar territory for our guest today. Evan Syett has written and or produced in virtually every medium. He started out as a stand-up comic. I guess you can tell that. He was quickly spotted by David Letterman and offered a spot on a special episode featuring young talent. He then moved into writing and was an integral part of the team that made the Arsenio Hall Show the first late-night program in 30 years to give The Tonight Show a run for its money. That's for the generation that still knows what those two shows are. He then moved to a very interesting assignment called Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. After that, Evan wrote and produced the highest-rated special in the Learning Channel's history, The 70s, From Bell Bottoms to Boogie Shoes. He perfected the book for a musical comedy, wrote a screenplay optioned by Penny Marshall, and even tried his hand at a game shows as the original writer of Ben Stein's Money. He is among Los Angeles's most in-demand speakers, a political pundit recognized by Dennis Prager as brilliant for his take on the unique power of the Judeo-Christian culture, and singled out by our friend Rush Limbaugh for his explanation of why liberals lie. And if I've left anything out, I know Evan won't hesitate to tell us. So please join me in welcoming our good friend back to Heritage, Evan Syett. Evan?
Thanks, John. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thank you to the Heritage. I believe it's the most viewed lecture in Heritage Foundation's history. That's how I understand it. I never quite know how to start these talks because having already given, as John was nice enough to point out, what has been called the unified field theory of liberalism, having already explained everything you need to know to understand why it is the modern liberal will side with evil over good, wrong over right, and the behaviors that lead to failure over those that lead to success, where do I go from there? What's my next talk to be about? Having explained it all, what's my next talk to be about? It seems to me I have 2 choices. I can simply give that same speech over and over and over again, or I can then take the unified field theory of liberalism and show how it applies in the specific to other areas. That's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to take the unified field theory of liberalism and show how it has led the mainstream media to get literally every major story of our lifetime, every major story of the past 60 years, every major story of what I call the modern liberal era, post-World War II through today, not just wrong, but as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to the truth, and in every case, their mischaracterization benefiting the evil, failed, and wrong, and working to the detriment of the good, right, and successful. The problem with the second option is that in order to show you how the unified field theory of liberalism applies in the specific, you have to know and understand the unified field theory of liberalism, which means I'm back to giving that original lecture again. So what I've taken to doing is giving a truncated version of that original talk to start all subsequent ones. How many of you have seen that original talk, by the way? Just a show of hands. How many of you? Okay, a handful of you. Listen, this is what I'm going to do because John's making me look arrogant and it's just not the case. I'm going to stick my fingers in my ears and turn around, tell everybody else how great that talk was. All right, so I'm going to give just the two most essential, what I call the first two laws of the unified field theory of liberalism. By the way, there are four laws and three corollaries. I outline them and detail them in the book. In the original talk, I began the original talk 6 years ago by saying, I've got to imagine that just about every one of us in this room recognizes that the Democrats are wrong on just about every issue. I said then, and I continue to say now, I'm here to propose to you that it's not just about every issue. It is quite literally every issue. And it is not just wrong, it is as wrong as wrong can be, diametrically opposed to the truth in every single way. And I proposed then, and I continue to propose now with more conviction, that this is not an accident, it is a function of their ideology. This ideology, don't confuse it with liberalism, it's not lowercase l liberalism, it's not uppercase L liberalism, classical liberalism. It is a standalone ideology that was first proposed by Jean-Jacques Rousseau and rejected for centuries as, forgive the choice of words, but it's the correct word, moronic, until post-World War II, when technologies and medicines and advances came so fast and furious and so great that a good part of the population could afford to be morons because there was nothing they could do that would be wrong because there was nothing that they did. You know, you used to have to be smart to avoid disease, hunger, poverty, and physical pain. Just before we were born, those things were vanquished from this world. Just before I was born, people had to worry and they had to be smart. They had to use their brain to avoid polio. Polio? Vanquished. Chickenpox? Vanquished. Smallpox? Vanquished. The flu had only recently, in the scheme of things, wiped out two-thirds of a continent. By the time I was born, it was a three-day paid vacation where you sat and watched any of 1,000 TV channels, so you had to go back to work. So post-World War II, there was this ideology that had been around forever that people had rejected but could now be accepted by a good many people because they didn't have to be smart. I offer up the two laws of the unified field theory of liberalism that you need to know right now. Here they are. The first is that the modern liberal was raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. In the 1980s, thinking was officially outlawed. It was deemed by the children of the 60s, the first generation to be born after World War II, when you didn't need to be smart, it was deemed by the children of the 60s to be a hate crime, an act so heinous as to require one to assiduously avoid it and revile, despise, hate anyone who engages in it. The thinking behind the outlawing of thinking is this. Anything that you believe, anything the individual believes, is going to have been so tainted by his personal prejudices. Prejudices we all have. Prejudices we can't help but have is just part of the human experience. Prejudices based on things like the color of your skin, the nation of your ancestry, your height, your weight, your sex, and so on. Anything the individual believes is going to be so tainted by their personal prejudices that the only way not to be a bigot is to never think at all. The second essential law, the second law of the unified field theory of liberalism, is that indiscriminateness of thought does not lead to indiscriminateness of policy. It leads to siding invariably and inevitably. There is nothing else it can lead to but to siding with evil over good, wrong over right, ugly over beautiful, profane over the holy. Why? Because if nothing is better than anything else, if no culture is better than any other, if no religion is better than any other, if no form of governance is better than any other, if no behavior is better than any other, if no familial construct is better than any other, then success is unjust. Why should something, somebody, some business, why should something succeed if it's not better than anything else? In this paradigm, failure, as proved by nothing other than the fact that it has failed, is proof positive that the failure has somehow been victimized. Why should a person, a nation, a business, a culture fail if it's not worse than anything else? And the same is true in every permutation. Every single one, whether it's beautiful and ugly. Why should we consider a piece of work beautiful when it's not beautiful? That can only be society's bigotries. Therefore, it becomes a moral imperative to right that injustice and to say that the beautiful isn't beautiful. In fact, it's ugly because it's bigotry. It is to right the injustice of taking the ugly, which isn't ugly, and saying it's just a victim of bigotry. So they will give an award to a song that has no aesthetic criteria to be the best song. Like it's hard out here for a pimp. They will take an artwork, forgive me, they do this on purpose to force us to vulgarize ourselves, but they will take an artwork, a photograph of a cross in a glass of a man's urine, and that's award-winning art. Based on what? It's based on the inevitable outcome of if you're not willing to use your intellect to discriminate and find the beautiful, find the better, find the morally superior. If everything must be deemed equal, that doesn't make everything meet in the middle. Indiscriminateness of thought does not lead to indiscriminateness of policy. It leads to a 180-degree flip where the successful has somehow cheated and the more successful has greatly cheated. And at a certain point, great and sustained success and failure is proof positive not only of great and sustained injustice, but that this injustice is intentional and part of an evil conspiracy. Why a conspiracy? Easy. Figure it out. Think about it. Let's say you were playing roulette. No number is better than any other number in roulette. So when one number comes up the winner and some people win and some people lose, that's not fair, that's not right. But you can't say that the winner was smarter or harder working or better than the loser. But what if that same number were to come up 5 times in a row and the same people win and the same people lose? Well, that might not yet prove conspiracy, but that's a cosmic injustice. It isn't right. It isn't fair. You can actually envision the losers looking over the winner's chips and saying, "You didn't build that." And demanding some income redistribution. But now, what if that same number were to come up 20, 30, 40, 50 times in a row and the same people win and the same people lose? Well, now you don't even have to know how it's done. It's a given. The game is fixed. The winners are in on a conspiracy. And it's a social justice demand that not only is that income redistributed, but that the cheaters, the conspirators, be punished. They were raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative because its opposite is discrimination. And indiscriminateness of thought does not lead to indiscriminateness of policy. It leads to siding only and always. There is nothing else it can lead to. But working on behalf of the evil, failed, wrong, ugly, profane, and against all that is good, right, and successful. So let's see if those first two laws of the unified field theory of liberalism apply in the specific to the mainstream media. And I think the first thing that I would have to establish, the first thing I would have to prove, is has the mainstream media really gotten literally every major story of the past 60 years, not just wrong, but as wrong can be? Diametrically opposed to the truth with their mischaracterizations, always benefiting the evil, failed, and wrong, and undermining the good, right, and successful. And to do this, I want to turn to one of the good guys. He's a writer for the Wall Street Journal by the name of Brett Stevens. And please, everybody, forgive my voice. I've been doing this day in and day out, promoting the book. And several years back, Stevens began a piece by saying, an historian, looking back at the contemporary journalism, leading up to the major events of modern times, looking for clues in that reporting as to the major events that were about to transpire, will have found that reporting to have been mostly useless. Stevens is wrong. He's wrong in that he doesn't go anywhere near far enough. Not only would an historian looking back through the reporting have found it useless in anticipating what then happened, anyone who trusted that reporting would have been led to anticipate exactly the opposite of what then transpired. I want you guys to think of our news media, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, CNN, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, et cetera, et cetera. I want you to think of them as our personal intelligence agencies. All right, there are operatives in the field, reporters, sending back reports that give us inside intelligence as to what's going on in these foreign locations, places that we can't be. If you trusted these sources as your source for intelligence in order to make decisions, you would have been led to anticipate exactly the opposite of what then came to be. Stephen's office, for example, and many of us in this room will remember how stunned we were. Stunned at the collapse of the Soviet Union. How is it that we were caught so completely unawares? After all, an empire doesn't collapse in a day, a week, a month, or a year, any more than it's built in a day, a week, a month, or a year. So how is it that we were caught so completely unawares? Because up to a point, Stevens is right. The reporting in the mainstream media was useless in helping us to anticipate what then came to be. But it was worse than useless, because while the empire was crumbling to non-existence, they were still telling us the Soviet Union is a co-equal superpower. The reporting was telling us that the Soviet Union was tied for first for the most powerful and viable nation in all of human history while it was crumbling to non-existence. Folks, that's not a little bit off. That is diametrically opposed to the truth. In this case, the mischaracterization making an evil empire appear stronger than in fact it was. There's the paradigm from 2007. Not just wrong, but as wrong can be. The mischaracterizations, the mistakes, the errors, whatever you want to call them, invariably working to benefit the evil, failed, and wrong, or hurt the good, right, and successful. So Stevens offers a second example. Most of us in this room will remember that during the 1980s, we were being told that Japan was an unstoppable economic juggernaut. This as they are about to plummet into what is now a decades-long recession. Unstoppable economic juggernaut, decades-long recession. Folks, this is not a little bit off. This is diametrically opposed to the truth. In this case, the mischaracterization making a non-white, non-Western culture appear better, stronger, more successful than in fact it was. Just about every one of us in this room was stunned after 9/11 to learn how widespread the rise and spread of Islamic fascism across the globe. Why? Because the reporting was useless. But it was worse than useless, because while this Hitlerian ideology was spreading across the globe, we were being told, in fact, we're still being told, that Islam is a religion of peace. The most Hitlerian, perhaps the only Hitlerian ideology on the planet today, we're being told is a religion of peace. Folks, that's not a little bit off. It is diametrically opposed to the truth, in this case, making the most violent and vile ideology on the planet appear to be the best. Christianity is a religion of violence, according to them. Islam is a religion of peace. Stevens offers a fourth example. You have to be a little bit older to remember this one. I'm a little bit older, so I do remember this one. But throughout the 70s and 80s, we were being told that Americans are evil, horrible, lawless gunslingers. It was the wild, wild west. Our flagship city, New York City, this was the cover of Time magazine, was, quote, ungovernable. That's how rotten we are. Along comes Rudy Giuliani, and not only is New York City governable, it's the safest large city in the world. Ungovernable, the safest large city in the world. Folks, that's not a little bit off. It is diametrically opposed to the truth. In this case, making the good and wonderful people of America appear more rotten than in fact we are. I don't remember Stevens mentioning the Vietnam War and the Tet Offensive, but we were being told that this battle was a back-breaking defeat for freedom and liberty and democracy and, yes, hope and change. When in reality, it was a war-ending defeat for the forces of the most murderous ideology in all of human history, communism. Folks, that's every major story of our lifetime, from the Vietnam War to the Cold War, to the collapse of the Soviet Union, to the rise and spread of Islamic fascism, to the global economy, to our streets here at home. Every single one of them fits the paradigm that I established in 2007 to perfection. Before I get into the why, because it is such a powerful claim, and it's so important that you not only hear it and think it's clever, but get it and know it's true. I'm going to give you just a couple more examples, and I swear I'll get into the whys. Because if your source for intelligence during the first battle to liberate the people of Iraq was the New York Times, you were being told that our forces were pinned down, that it was a bloodbath. They even used the Q word, folks. Talk to me, I'm here. It was a quagmire. When our forces arrived in Baghdad 3 weeks later, it was, in fact, the culmination of the swiftest military victory of its kind in all of human history. Never before in human history had that much enemy territory been traversed in so short a period of time. Quagmire was, in fact, the swiftest military victory of its kind in all of human history. If CNN had been your source for intelligence leading up to the first democratic vote in Iraq, lowercase d, you were being told that our mission was a failure, that the streets were chaotic, that virtually no one would go out and vote, and those who did would be mowed down by Al-Qaeda. What then happened? Exactly the opposite. Millions of people went out and voted. A higher percentage of Iraqis voted in that election than Americans voted in our own election, which had taken place only a few weeks prior. Not only did millions of Iraqis go out and vote, they dipped their fingers in purple and they danced in the streets for hours. And to my knowledge, not a single one, not one, was killed by Al-Qaeda on that day. We can go on and on. The Tea Party movement is a handful of violent kooks, while the Occupy Wall Street movement is a mass movement of thoughtful and loving and caring, peaceful people. No matter what it is, it's diametrically opposed to the truth, always to the advantage of the evil, failed, and wrong. So the question becomes why? Because I don't think there's a single one of us in this room who thinks Katie Couric is an evil genius. On two counts. All right, she's not evil, and she's far from a genius. In fact, she happens to be a moron. She does. She happens. I don't mean she's particularly incapable of thought. It's just thought doesn't interest her. And I'm not picking on her. By the way, the fact that she is the most recent recipient of the Walter Cronkite Award for Excellence in Television Journalism says nothing about her skills as a journalist and says everything about how little excellence matters to the folks at the University of Southern California who give out that award. If this former daytime chat show host is the most excellent journalist in all of television, how bad must Wolf Blitzer be? So why does she do it? Why does Anderson Cooper do it? He's not an evil genius. He's a professional cutie pie. And he's good at it. He is a cutie pie, isn't he? Yeah, so look, I don't go that way. But if I did, I think Andy might be my guy. That's how cute the guy is. So why does he do it? Why does he take every news story that crosses his desk, flip it on its head, and work on behalf of all that is evil, failed, and wrong? It's not just them. As I just pointed out, it's across the board, save for Fox News, who we will discuss, and through the decades. Why do they do it? And here's the answer. If I were to poll the great journalists of all time, I'm worried I'm going to have my Marco Rubio moment. If I were to poll the great journalists of all time and ask them, and by the way, by great, I don't mean the most famous, I don't mean the richest, I don't mean the tallest, I don't mean those who get the best seats at the theater. What I mean by great is simply this. Those whose reporting best helped their followers, their readers or their viewers or their listeners, anticipate what then in fact came next. And I were to ask them, what is the most important trait in good and accurate reporting? Let me ask you guys, what is the most important trait in good and accurate reporting? Anybody? Nobody? Truth? How do you get to the truth? Would anybody object to objectivity? Anybody? Clearly, those who are best able to report what is objectively taking place will help their readers, their viewers, or their listeners anticipate what objectively comes next. All right, now let me introduce you to a gentleman who is arguably the most beloved and influential modern liberal of all. His name is Howard Zinn. Amongst Zinn's other accomplishments, his many accomplishments, he is the author of the single most assigned textbook on America and American history in our schools. This means that chances are good that your children, my children, are learning about our history from this man. Further, They are learning about everything else from a school that thinks that this author is the quintessential author on this subject. So everything that your child is learning, that your children today are learning, comes from people who share Zinn's beliefs. And what Zinn said is this, and I quote, "Objectivity is impossible. It is also undesirable." That is, if you think that history, and remember, journalism is just the first draft of history. If you think that history should serve a social purpose, if you think that it should in some way advance the causes of humanity, then you make your choices based on that. Zinn is an ideologue. I don't think we'd have much disagreement. I don't think I'd get in much trouble for saying he's a left-wing ideologue. But Katie Couric isn't an ideologue. She hasn't thought through the issues and said, this is how I think I can advance the causes of mankind. Anderson Cooper isn't an ideologue. So why do they do Zinn's dirty work? It's because those who recognize that the truth is undesirable, the left-wing ideologues who now run the schools and the universities and the entertainment industry, control the Democratic Party, and what am I leaving out? I guess I'm leaving out journalism. The ideologues have taught from a very young age, from the first time they get their hands on our children, which is why my book is called The Kindergarten of Eden. That's when they first get a hold of our children on a first-time basis, and they have taught our children that objectivity is impossible. Those who see objectivity as undesirable have brainwashed successive generations into thinking it is impossible. Folks, what is it? And they told me ahead of time they were going to leave. But Mom, Dad, did you really have... It's tough when you have Jewish relatives. They can only take so much conservatism, then they're out of here. Those who recognize that the truth is undesirable because it gets in the way of their utopian agenda, running the schools now and journalism, etc., have brainwashed successive generations into believing objectivity is impossible. What is it that makes objectivity impossible, folks? Talk to me. Well, it's the idea that anything you believe is going to be so tainted by your personal prejudices that the only way not to be a bigot, or in this case, your reporting is going to be so tainted by your personal prejudices that the only way to be a fair reporter is to not be objective. So now the most important trait in good and accurate reporting, objectivity, is not just undesirable, it's an act of evil. To report objectively is the evil of bigotry, which is why the left hates Fox News. They don't hate Fox News because Fox News is wrong. First of all, Fox News is far more accurate than any of these other outlets, and I'll prove that to you in a moment. But you don't hate people because they're wrong. I don't hate Katie Couric. I don't hate Anderson Cooper. I wish they weren't on the air. I wish they'd learn more. But I don't hate them. They hate Fox News. Why? It has nothing to do with Fox News being wrong. It's because Fox News is objective. And by being objective, Fox News is committing the hate crime of discriminating thought. And by the way, here's how I know Fox News is far more accurate than any of these other outlets. Because if my source for intelligence leading up to the first vote in Iraq was CNN, when what came to be, I was stunned. I didn't think anybody was going to go out and vote. Millions did. If Fox News had been my source for intelligence, I might not have known how many would turn out. I might not have known what the color would be. I might not have known that nobody would be killed. But when what came to be, if Fox News was my source for intelligence, I was far better prepared. If the New York Times had been my source for intelligence during the first battle to liberate the people of Iraq, when came to be, I was stunned. I thought they were in a quagmire. If Fox News had been my source for intelligence, I might not have known the days. You know what? Things might have happened along the way that would have slowed their progression. But when what came to be, if Fox News had been my source for intelligence, I would have been far better prepared. So now that the mainstream media is taught they must never, ever, 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 ever be objective, it would be an act of villainy, an act of bigotry, a heinous crime to be objective. What is the trait they seek? Because the truth is, Anderson Cooper does want to be a good journalist. I don't know how hard he wants to work to be a good journalist, but he'd like to be a good journalist. Katie Kirk, and I'm only picking on them because they're the first two names that come up in my head across the board. What is the trait that they seek to employ to be great journalists? It's a concept that can make you think it's objectivity. It sounds attractive like objectivity is, but in fact, it is its exact opposite. While they are taught that they must never, ever, ever be objective in their reporting, they are taught they must always be neutral. What's the difference between objectivity and neutrality? Let me start with a silly example. Let's say that, like Keith Olbermann, your history is as a sports reporter. Since this is my story, the assignment is he's covering the New York Jets-Cincinnati Bengals game, and the Jets come in 12-1. I said, it's my story. I can make up whatever I want. The Bengals come in 1-12. The Jets play so well. The Bengals play so poorly, just as their records would indicate. So the Jets win the game 87-3. Now, if you're an objective reporter, your story is all about how the Jets are a better team. You then seek out the most salient facts to include in the body of your story to make the argument to support your claim that the Jets are a better team. But what if from the first time your mom and dad turned on Buster Bunny and Sesame Street, thinking that you were learning the ABCs and the 1-2-3s, but you were really being softened up for liberalism? What if it began on a full-time basis in an intense manner the day you entered kindergarten? Growing more intense in junior high school, graduate school, postgraduate school, journalism school, and the corporate ideology at the New York Times, CBS, CNN, that you must never say that one football team is better than any other. How do you know that's not just your prejudices? How do you know 100% sure that you don't just think the Jets are a better team because you grew up near an airport and you always loved airplanes? How can you be 100% sure you don't just think the Bengals are a lesser team because your favorite uncle was eaten by a tiger? So the way to make sure there is absolutely no bigotry, no bias in your reporting, 100% free of bias, you must not say any football team is better than any other. Now, not only do you get every single story wrong, the Jets are a better team than the Bengals, but now the body of your story changes. The purpose of your story changes. Suddenly now you have to explain how it is that two equally good teams came to such disparate outcomes. Obviously, somehow, the Jets cheated. But this is not a little bit of cheating. This isn't a three-point victory. 87-3, this must have been long and sustained cheating. In other words, it has to be an evil conspiracy. After all, why didn't the referees call penalties if there were that many and they were so flagrant? And it's going to be an even bigger conspiracy because why didn't the announcers in the booth point out the penalties even if the refs didn't call it? And who could possibly afford a conspiracy of that size? Anybody? The evil 1%ers, the club owners. Why would they do such a thing? Oh, I can figure out why. Because they don't want that little tiny market, Cincinnati, in the Super Bowl. They want New York, major market, big money for those 1%ers. And the better the Jets are, the more they must have cheated. The worse the Bengals are, the more they must have been victimized. And I said when I started, that's a silly example. And the only reason it's silly is because sports are so overwhelmingly objective that you can't make up for stupidity with pseudo-intellectual psychobabble. All right? It doesn't matter if the guy drops the ball 3 times in a row. He's not a good receiver. It doesn't matter how much he screams bigotry and racism that his great-great-grandfather was Muslim and the football used to be made of a pigskin. You catch the ball, you drop the ball, which is why, by the way, sports is the only field in entertainment that is overwhelmingly conservative. Every other part of the entertainment, they're just as rich as the Hollywood folks. They're just as beautiful in their own ways as the Hollywood folks. They get just as rich, just as young as the folks in Hollywood, and yet you'll see them thanking God, you'll see them. Why? Because they actually had to earn their achievement, and good and bad is proven by fact. But what if, from the earliest of ages, you were told you must not see any culture as better than any other. Now, not only are you going to get everything wrong because some cultures are better than others, but now you have to explain how two equally good cultures came out to such disparate outcomes. I'm going to go off the media for a second. I'll return to the media in a moment. But Barack Obama was asked point blank, do you believe in American exceptionalism? And he gave a very clever, very politic answer in which he said yes, but made very clear right afterwards he really means no. What he said was, yes, I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I'm sure the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism. In other words, his appreciation for America isn't that he thought through our Constitution and believes it to be better. It's not that he thought through our Judeo-Christian heritage and found it to be exceptional. It's not that he looked at our Protestant work ethic and believed it to be exceptional. Basically, he just is rooting for the home team. You know, it's kind of the way if somebody asked you, do you think the Chicago Cubs are an exceptional team? If you live in Chicago, you might say, yeah, because they have your heart, but not your head. They stink. But now Obama, and it's not just Obama, and my old boss Bill Maher said the same thing. If America isn't exceptional, then how do you explain our exceptional prosperity? How do you explain our exceptional strength? Well, first of all, it's unjust. Why should we be so rich if we're nothing special? But given that we are the most prosperous nation in all of human history, the strongest nation in all of human history, Barack Obama and those who share his ideology have no choice but to see America as the greatest injustice in all of human history. So go back to the mainstream media and let's look at the Middle East. And we thinking people, I call us right-thinking people, and folks, buy my book. Save my voice, buy the book. Of course, you have to kill a tree, so it's actually two reasons to do it. It boggles our minds. How can the liberals have such hate for this tiny, wonderful democracy of Israel? They're supposed to be liberals. They have women's rights. They have gay rights. They have freedom of the press, freedom of speech. And they hate this nation like no other nation on earth. And they look at the Palestinians and the Islamists and the Arabs in general, not the Arabs in general, mostly the Islamists, and they see them as the victims. How can it be? How come they report? Why do they do this? It's because if you start out saying that the Arabs and the Israelis are equally good cultures, if you start out saying, as they must, these reporters must start out with the notion that the Jews and the Palestinians both want peace. After all, the Palestinians would be a bad culture if they didn't want peace. So they're not allowed to think that. That might just be their prejudices. So they must start with the conclusion that both sides want peace. Then why are the Palestinians doing such horrible things? Why are they blowing up buses in Israel? Well, it has to be. It can't be their culture. So it has to be something the Jews did to provoke them. Now they will look through and cherry pick and spin and manipulate. Oh, wait, didn't a Jew build a house in Jerusalem 3 weeks ago? Oh, that must be, and that becomes the salient part of the story. And the more heinous the attack, the more evil the provocation must have been. Indiscriminateness of thought does not lead to indiscriminateness of policy. That's what the liberal believes, that if you eliminate discriminating thought, you'll eliminate things to disagree about. We won't fight. We won't kill each other. We won't scream and yell. We won't hurt each other. If you eliminate thinking, they're going to have this paradise, the kindergarten of Eden. That's not what happens. They don't eliminate the recognition of right and wrong. They flip-flop it, and invariably there is nothing else they can do. They were raised to believe that indiscriminateness is a moral imperative, and indiscriminateness of thought leads only and always to siding with evil, failure, and wrong. All right, after you guys give me a collective, wow, I can't, wow, that's genius. You can ask questions. Anybody? Yes, sir, you can applaud.
I'm assuming you want questions.
I do, I'm going to take questions, but I want applause. Listen, I didn't get it.
You're too subtle.
I got it.
That's the trouble.
You know, I didn't get into this business for this thinking crap. I got into it for the applause. All right?
We will be glad to take questions. There is a microphone. If you'll please wait till that gets to you and identify yourself if you don't mind, and we'll start off over on the far side, Andrew.
Yes, sir. My name is Cammy Butt, and I write for the Pakistani Spectator, and my question is about the credibility of American media in terms of our involvement in Afghanistan and Afghanistan and Iraq, there were only two ladies who opposed our involvement with those countries, and even most conservative Republicans agree with them. Many Republicans call them crazy, Cynthia McKinney and Sheila Jackson.
And by the way, she's crazy.
But what would you say, even many Republicans are thinking that we wasted huge resources in both these Muslim countries, and we didn't get the result that we were intending to get from Afghanistan.
Okay, first of all, I am standing here at the Heritage Foundation, where they have people who do this for, they sit there all day and think, and, you know, most of my day is spent watching cartoons. So that question's a little bit too deep for me. I don't know the answer as to the righteousness of our involvement, and whether it should have been more, whether it should have been less, whether it should have started earlier, whether it should have ended. I don't want to get into that. What I will say is this: Cynthia McKinney is not a thinking person. My work is out of my respect for thought. You can be a thoughtful person and be wrong. Actually, that's never happened to me, but I've heard that it happens to other people. And so when you bring up names, and I don't know the answer to your question, but as long as people are weighing the facts, making themselves knowledgeable, engaging their morality and their intellect to come to a decision, at the very least, I can then have a debate and discussion with them. You cannot have a debate and discussion with a modern liberal because they arrive at their beliefs without benefit of thought. And then when it's time for them to engage you in debate, they don't have the benefit of thought with which to persuade you. And so then you just end up being called names, screamed at, and they try it. They call you racist, bigot, and that's the end of that. So the specifics, I don't know. But if these are thinking people with legitimate points, I'd love to hear them.
And then on down the road.
Thank you. I'm Dino Drury. The question I would have for you is the mainstream media are not the only ones who got big things wrong, like the fall of the Soviet Union. The Central Intelligence Agency, which is supposed to be keeping track of such things, has a horrible record of prediction.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when it's right, it's the exception and not the rule on most of these big developments. So is it possible that the phenomenon that you describe has a much broader pathology?
Yeah, there's no doubt, first of all, that modern liberalism has infected, but that's not what your question is. But yes, and I don't think more than once or twice in, how long did I speak, 40 minutes or whatever it was, that I even mentioned the words Republican and Democrat. So it's modern liberalism that concerns me. You point out the fall of the Soviet Union was missed by a great many people. Interestingly enough, though, not by Ronald Reagan, that dunce. But it's the reason that I went on and on and on and on listing every major story of my lifetime. And then even after I felt that I had proved the pattern, I still felt I needed to go on and on and on and on and give you more examples. So, yes, in the case of the Soviet Union, perhaps it wasn't a reflection of this ideology. What about all the others? So I'll give you a pass on that one. Fine, that's not modern liberalism.
Al Milliken, AM Media. I was curious how you've seen the way media has put together, professed what liberals and conservatives like on the same show. I noticed last week Alan Combs got Bill O'Reilly very upset, very emotional. It seemed more than he used to do with Sean Hannity. But Hannity, you think he's better off alone or with a partner?
Plus also Hannity made his own bed. He hired Combs, so.
Oh, okay. And so, like the five on Fox, where there's like four conservatives against one liberal, how do you view that?
Yeah.
I mean, there's okay, the conservatives vary somewhat. I mean, there's usually libertarians.
No, I get the question. That is a – I'm sorry?
That's balanced, isn't it?
Well, you know what? In truth, that is the exact ratio – except liberal to conservative on every other show that's on the air. And I used to write Politically Incorrect. I did it for a good number of years. You had three liberals, one pseudo-conservative, and Marr, the moderator, who would then make sure the conservative never spoke or said just enough that he could not be pounced on. You go over to CNN where they had a cartoon character. I got to be careful. He works in this town. I'm not going to talk about him. But where they had one conservative – surrounded by three liberals and Wolf Blitzer as the moderator on the crossfire or the Situation Room, whatever it was. Go on The View. What do you have? You got your three or four baddie leftists who don't know anything, because what does Whoopi Goldberg know and how did she learn it? You know, what does Joy Behar know and what, how did she learn it? You had these people who have never done anything surrounding this one cartoon caricature of what the leftist thinks a conservative is. So if you finally have this paradigm, this ratio on one show on Fox News, I'm thrilled.
Another question?
Sure.
If not, I know. Sure. We're going to go behind you first, Terry. Youth before
beauty.
Maturity.
Hello, I'm Matthew Powers. I used to be a liberal.
Yes.
So you have a convert
welcome
here at least.
Welcome.
Yes, it's very welcome here, I found. So you mentioned these past examples. I'm wondering about current examples. Like, there's a lot of talk about the collapse of America now and how China's going to take over.
Okay, I have a forgive me. Yeah, I have a problem.
Also, one more.
Okay.
Also, how would you... What would you say, like, a person like Paul Krugman's role is in this current paradigm?
Yeah.
What would you ascribe?
Do you steal your question, Terry?
All right. Again, I try to stay within my area of expertise. And my area of – one of the things that I use as a touchstone, as a way of just testing if my theories are right, is I already know the conclusion. So to ask me what's being reported today based on what might happen tomorrow, I don't want to go there. My sense of it is that the pattern's going to continue, and you do see, I see it over and over again, but in order to prove myself right, it has to be something that's already come to a sort of conclusion. If you trusted the mainstream media as your source leading up to, during the Arab Spring, you thought we were going to have Jeffersonian democracy, and the Fox News, who reported what then came to be, were bigots and racists and Islamophobes for reporting the truth. So you see it over and over and over again, but I can't pat myself on the back for a prediction because that's not what I do. Paul Krugman, his job is to offer pseudo authority to the nonsense coming out of the left.
Here's John's question.
Thanks very much, Terry Miller from the Heritage Foundation.
Hey, Terry.
One of the great.
Thanks for coming so far to see me.
It was a struggle. One of the great success stories of America and Barack Obama's election is perhaps the apotheosis of this, is the struggle against bigotry, against racial bigotry. Mm-hmm. In common culture, we use the word discrimination mm-hmm. to describe what we have overcome in that struggle. And yet your whole talk or your thesis, if I understand correctly, is about the need to discriminate in mm-hmm. thinking. Between good and evil.
Right and wrong,
better
or worse.
Would
yes,
be,
sir.
How can we go about rehabilitating the concept of intellectual discrimination as something that is not only valuable but necessary?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is, you know, we're not looking for solutions here. Liberals look for solutions. We're looking to ameliorate. We're looking to make things better at every turn with every one of our actions. So there's no panacea. There's no silver bullet. We need to first and foremost return the concept, the wedding of merit and reward. The left seeks to, because they don't believe in the concept of merit that says something's better than something else, has completely severed that relationship. Whether it's the idea of collective bargaining, which by definition says the hardest, best worker doesn't make a penny more than the laziest, most incompetent worker. Whether it's grade inflations in the school because self-esteem is more important than merit and accomplishment. So... is there a specific place to begin? No, at every turn, every opportunity you have as individuals, you have as an organization, find ways to just tie one more string back together in that relationship between reward and merit. You know, when I do this in Los Angeles, I don't mind because as a conservative, I got nowhere to go.
Maybe I was Robert Williams, and I did walk here.
Thank you. Walking, you see, I don't know what that is either.
The climate variation. I'm old enough to remember the coming ice age, global
Absolutely.
Warming. Now it's climate change.
Right.
So I'm curious how your theory applies to that.
The very first time I was here, I mentioned a friend of mine, and I don't know if he's in disrepute in this town now. I hope he isn't. But my friend David Frum wrote a great book about the 70s. That's how I met him, was when I was doing my documentary on the 70s. And he said it was like Mikado. It didn't really matter whose name was on the executioner's list so long as there was something on the list. You know, the terror was enough to serve the purpose. It wasn't a matter of truth or justice. And it's the same thing with the environment. It doesn't matter what they're claiming is about, some horror. They just need a global horror, because that way you won't look at – think of John Lennon's song, No Countries. Well, if you have global warming or global freezing, they've if you've got no religions, that all, and they can have this utopia in which there's no discriminating thought on this earth because we're all looking up at the heavens or at the rains or whatever. So it's complete nonsense, and as the data – proved it to be nonsense, they simply just changed the field. They just changed the terror. Okay, my pleasure.
Anybody else? All right. We'll applaud again.
Completely without hieroglyphics. No teleprompter, folks.
We have, I'm sure, lots of friends now after this last hour. We do thank you for your attendance. We do have the books available outside, and I know Evan will be glad to sign them and certainly be glad to talk further with you in spite of his poor throat today. But please join him, and thank him again, and we'll see you at another occasion.